loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Is it back to square one in Syria? After the breakdown of the ceasefire, Russia says the U.S. failed to separate so-called moderate rebels from terrorist organizations, and the U.S. rattles the saber and alludes to its own possible larger military intervention. President Obama will send 600 more troops to Iraq in the last months of his presidency. 13 years after its murderous invasion of Iraq, over 5,000 troops remain in the country managing the sectarian bloodletting that the U.S. occupation instigated. The resistance to the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline continues at Standing Rock as the government intensifies its repression. 21 people were arrested this Wednesday during a peaceful protest, but activists are showing no signs of going anywhere despite the brutal tactics from the military-style law enforcement. But first, we turn to Syria. We are joined from Beirut by political analyst Marwa Osman and in studio by Walter Smolarek, producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Welcome, Marwa and Walter.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Marwa, let's start with you. This U.S. State Department spokesperson, John Kirby, who's a retired admiral and now the spokesperson for the State Department, said that if the war in Syria rages on, quote, more Russian lives will be lost, more Russian aircraft will be shot down, as extremist groups will continue to exploit the vacuums that are there in Syria to expand their operations, which could include attacks against Russian interests, perhaps even Russian cities. And then he said there will be Russians coming back in body bags. I mean, all of this must be perceived in Russia as a veiled threat.
A threat, yes. That's a very obvious and a very blatant threat by the United States of America, on behalf of the spokesperson. I mean, he speaks on behalf of the United States of America. So his words are perceived as a definite threat. And not only that, also the words of John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, Mr. John Kerry, who said that during the phone call on Wednesday with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, that not only they will stop coordinating with Russia, but the escalation will just increase and that the terrorists will hit harder. By saying that, and also by the speech that was recorded for Jabhat Ahrar al-Sham leader and the Nusra leaders as well, saying that they get their ammunition and their new weapons from the U.S., putting those two pieces of puzzle together, we get that this is a war being waged on Syria on behalf of the U.S. targeting Russia and Syria using the proxy so-called moderate rebels on the ground who are getting their ammunition and the weapons and the coordinations from the U.S. Now, to counter these threats, we heard Ms. Maria Zakharova, she's the spokesperson of the foreign ministry, of the Russian foreign ministry, saying that the Russian military and the Russian government as well are ready to give the coordinates of the U.S. so-called consultants in the areas of the terrorists residing inside of Aleppo. So now we are hearing threats and counter threats. So we are at a level of high risk. And I mean, if the major players in this proxy war are saying this, then by God, no one knows what is going on the ground and the amount of casualties falling right now on the ground. So it's beyond a threat. It is an absolute war. It is an open war. And if this continues, I might add that it won't end in the upcoming 5 years because we perceive it that it will end in 5 years. But if this goes on, I don't think so.
Walter Smolarek, that was Marwa Osman talking about what is not a perceived threat, but a real threat by the U.S. government, by the State Department spokesperson and John Kerry against Russia. After the collapse of the ceasefire, since the beginning, the United States has blamed the Russians for the collapse of the ceasefire. But it was the United States military, the Pentagon, the same Pentagon that we're hearing from now, that said they weren't even sure that they would support the ceasefire, even after President Obama had gone along with Kerry's proposal. In other words, that would be technically and legally insubordination on the part of the uniformed officers and the Secretary of Defense. But then they went ahead and they bombed Syrian Arab Army positions, not al-Nusra, not al-Qaeda, not ISIS, Syrian Arab Army positions that were fighting terrorists and killed more than 62 Syrians. I mean, Did the Pentagon sabotage the ceasefire and then blame the Russians?
I think it's quite clear that that is what they did. You know, it's important from a lot of different angles. Of course, it's something that's going to prolong the suffering of the people of Syria in a horrible way. It's also very significant in terms of civil-military relations in the United States. I mean, effectively, you're right, the Pentagon vetoed a decision from the political leadership, from the State Department. And the basis of that really was that if the ceasefire had lasted more than 1 week, I believe, then they would be required to set up a joint monitoring center with Russia, which would involve some limited, very limited level of intelligence sharing. And of course, they see Russia, or at least they're sort of trying to hype up Russia as the great threat of the future. You know, that's the reason why they need a massively expanded budget. That's the reason why the U.S. should invest in these expensive, extremely expensive new weapons. So, yeah, I mean, I think that it is quite clear that the attack on the Syrian government position in Deir ez-Zor was intentional. It would be one thing if, you know, it was a position that was changing hands very rapidly and several times between ISIS and the government forces. But that was not the case. They were monitoring this area for quite some time prior to the airstrike. They must have known that it was a government position. They have extremely accurate satellite imaging. And in fact, when they did bomb that position, it was the ISIS fighters that came in and took it over, you know, momentarily before it was taken back
and
by government forces.
And the U.S. bombing went on and on and on. It was F-15 jets. It was A-10 Warthog planes. I mean, planes that shoot 5,000 bullets per minute. And that attack, Marwa, that went on for, I think, almost an hour, according to the reports by the Syrian Arab Army.
Yes, 55 minutes, yes. And beyond that, there's something very important that we should mention about what happened in Deir ez-Zor, that 2 days prior to the attack, the Syrian Arab Army set an only competition between the U.S. and ISIS just 2 days before the attack. And the attack that happened at the airport in Zor, the military base of the Syrian Arab Army has been there for the past 2 years. So there's no way that the United States of America had no idea that this base was for the Syrian Arab Army. And the interception of the audio conversation between ISIS leaders and U.S. is beyond hypocritical on the side of the U.S., especially on the side of Samantha Power, who now is accusing the Syrian Arab Army of trying to conquer Syria. Is she serious? Is she listening to what she's saying? So by doing that and by the attack, not only the ceasefire was broken, I believe that the ceasefire was brokered in the first place for this to happen in order to target the Syrian Arab Army and to give way for, I'm sorry to say this, but to give way for ISIS to invade.
Yeah, Walter Smolarek, the ceasefire seemed to be completely dead. There's an offensive going on that seems to be effective by the Syrian Arab Army, supported also by the Russian military. But yesterday, Russia offered to observe a 48-hour humanitarian pause in the fighting, rejecting U.S. demands for a 7-day ceasefire. Is it possible that there could be a resumption of some sort of ceasefire talks, or do you believe that both sides are sort of talking past each other at this point?
Well, of course, it is possible. I think it's unlikely for a couple of reasons. I mean, maybe there could be sort of a very momentary pause in the fighting. But what we saw from the last ceasefire attempt is that the armed opposition groups in Syria are fully unable to separate from the most extreme religious elements. Al-Nusra Front, the former Al-Nusra Front, many other organizations that are part of the Army of Conquest that captured Idlib. You know, these are integral parts of the armed opposition in Syria. And any kind of lasting ceasefire would require them to sort of draw a line of demarcation between themselves and the more extreme organizations. I don't think they can do that militarily.
Marwa, there was a lead editorial in the New York Times yesterday, the newspaper of record for the United States, certainly the record of the political establishment. And the headline was Putin's outlaw state. And in other words, characterizing Russia as an outlaw state and personally attributing it to Putin. It's not Russia's state, it's his state, and it's an outlaw state. And it's about Syria. It's also about Ukraine. But when you look at what's going on, even though the United States and Russia collaborated for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran nuclear arms agreement, even though there was an attempt to in Geneva and earlier in Vienna to start peace talks or some sort of resolution talks in Syria, even though there were efforts towards negotiations, where do you think it's all heading?
I'll tell you something. All the efforts for negotiations are collapsing. That's what we have been seeing for the past 6 years. And I'll tell you why. A ceasefire is never going to hold inside of Syria. There are four main reasons for that. The first and major one is that the U.S., the promises of the U.S. have never been reliable in the recent years. They make the promises, then they break them. They organize with the Russians, and then they just back on to their own words. So Russia has no reason or very little reason to actually trust any Western leader, the first and foremost the U.S. And the second thing, that the majority of the terrorist groups, or the so-called U.S.'s moderate rebels, have always rejected any sort of truce, which makes them very unpredictable, and they can be counted on to try to foil any kind of a ceasefire. And this is what we saw when Ahrar al-Sham said, we will not cut any ties with Nusra, and both the U.S. and Russia consider Nusra Front as terrorist organizations. Then you have the possibility that if actually U.S. and Russia succeed in, let's say, defeating ISIS or Jabhat Fateh al-Sham or Nusra, whatever they want to call them, what is to stop the other terrorist groups from continuing their offensive against the Syrian Arab Army and against the Syrian civilians? Nothing. There's no actual grounds for them to stop it. No one can control them. And there's also the peace talks in Geneva. I mean, even let's say the government goes with certain designated so-called moderate rebels, and they go and they all show up in Geneva. No side controls these rebels on the ground. Even the U.S., who has their own bases and their own coordinators and their own consultants, they cannot control them. These people cannot be controlled because basically they all go up to the head of the pyramid, which is Wahhabism. They have fatwas issued. Any fatwa can be issued, and they could just do whatever they want. So it's very risky. It's very scary. And at the same time, we say the headlines of these establishment newspapers in the U.S., it's funny. When you see that the Syrian government actually asked, according to an agreement signed between Russia and the Syrians, they asked the Russians to come and help them to oust terrorism from their country. And especially because terrorism was about, and it did attack several sites inside of Moscow and Chechnya as well. So it did actually reach Moscow because it's geographically close to Syria. And then you have the Ukrainian issue as well. I'm not going to go there. It's not our subject for tonight. But I would advise the people in the U.S. to get a map and look at the map and see where Russia is, where Ukraine is, where Syria is. And please just calculate the miles between the U.S. and all of these three countries. And then tell me who is actually invading the area, who is invading the sovereignty of other states, of other nations, and who is actually working and abiding by the agreements signed with the other states. So it's a bit confusing, I understand, for the American public. But if they just look at the map, they would understand that why would a U.S. military ship, be on the shores of Russia? Isn't that a threat? That's the only thing that I'm going to say about that.
Yeah, but Marwa, I want to stay with you for a moment because we have about 3.5 minutes left. I want to ask you, and maybe you can take 2 minutes, and then I'll ask Walter a final question. But talk about how important this battle, the Battle of Aleppo, is in terms of the destiny of Syria, the outcome of the war, and how strong are the terrorist organizations in the eastern part of Aleppo? Can they be defeated militarily?
They can, but they are strong. They have Tau missiles. There are certain people who are saying that they have even man pads, not only Tau missiles. So that's very horrific. They could get planes down. So but that's they are powerful. And I was watching yesterday an interview done with one of Ahrar al-Sham leaders, with a Swedish interviewer, with a Swedish host. And he was saying, literally, he was saying that they have tanks that were delivered to them from Libya through Turkey. They have advanced weapons from Qatari, Saudi, and Israeli commanders who were there, who are still there, who are giving them coordinates, who are giving them training, and who are giving them funding. He was also talking about millions and millions of dollars where they got from Saudis, from Turkish middlemen, and from Israelis as well. So we are talking about people with satellite technology, people with missile technology. So they are very, very risky. They are very dangerous. Yet, with the coordination between the Syrian Arab Army on the ground and the Russian Air Force in the air, I bet that they can be defeated, but it will cost a lot of lives. Because in the eastern part of Aleppo, they still see lots of towns where civilians are residing. And I have one scoop for you here to tell you about what's going on, especially there. The areas that are being hit, first, the Syrian people are working as spies now for the Syrian government. I'll tell you how. The Syrian government is sending via SMS on their mobile phones that if you are able to help us, to give us coordinates or give us names of local areas where terrorists reside, please do answer through SMS and no one will know because they don't have the technology in order to hack into people's phones. And this is what is happening. The Syrian civilians are helping their government to target certain areas for the terrorists through SMS. This is very important. This is how they are resisting. This is how they are fighting because they are besieged in these areas and they cannot leave. So it will take time, but I fully believe, according to the facts on the ground, that it is possible to defeat them.
Walter Smolarek, we have 1 minute left. Why can't the United States come to a resolution and end the war in Syria? It collaborated at different times with the Assad government, with Hafez Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad. They've worked together at times. They've been in conflict together. Why the perpetual war? 30 seconds.
Well, they view this as key to their geopolitical play for domination, not just in the Middle East, but in the world going forward. They are extremely paranoid about any alternate centers of power rising in the world. They see this as an existential threat with Russia primarily. And if they've invested so much political capital, so much military and economic assistance to the opposition groups, that to back away now would be such a humiliating defeat that it could be even on the scale of Iraq, maybe not quite that bad, but it would be something that really makes them stumble geopolitically. And they have absolutely zero regard for the suffering of the people of Syria, the intense trauma that they've gone through. And they're willing to just perpetuate this endless war, seemingly endless war, until they can get what they want or in the hopes of getting what they want.
Right. The politicians and bureaucrats in Washington, they don't pay a price. They don't do the bleeding. And Syria is just a pawn from their point of view on their larger global geostrategic chessboard. We've been talking with Marwa Osman. She is in Beirut. She is a political analyst. And we've been talking in studio with Walter Smolarek, producer of this show, Loud and Clear. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. President Obama will send 600 more U.S. troops to Iraq in the last months of his presidency. 13 years after its murderous invasion of Iraq, over 5,000 troops now remain in the country managing the sectarian bloodletting that the U.S. occupation instigated. We are joined by Raad Jarar, an Iraqi-American journalist and government relations manager at the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome back, Raad.
Thanks for having me again.
Tell us about the decision made by President Obama to send 600 more troops to Iraq. You know, he said no boots on the ground, but actually there are 5,000 or so boots on the ground. That's troops themselves. I don't know about private contractors. Why now in the final months of his administration, despite being elected in 2008 as the, quote, anti-war president?
This is a great question to ask. President Obama, he ran on a platform to become the peace president. He won a Nobel Peace Prize, prepaid Nobel Peace Prize, because of his promises to end wars. And unfortunately, now at the last months of his presidency, he is sending more troops to Iraq, proving that he is a war president, nothing more than another war president who is continuing the U.S. military intervention in Iraq that started back in 1991. So in addition to the 5,000 or so U.S. troops in Iraq now, there are others, maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of Iraqi militias who are funded and trained and equipped by the United States. They are fighting a dirty war and committing war crimes on a daily basis with our tax dollars. Many people have been arguing that the abuses in Iraq under the Obama administration, with all of the proxy wars going on, with all of us funding sectarian militias in Iraq, these abuses are even worse than the abuses that were committed under the administrations before. So unfortunately, there is no peace president legacy that will be left after President Obama leaves office. It will be a legacy similar to other presidents before him who destroyed Iraq.
ISIS in Iraq has been the pretext for the return of U.S. military soldiers and large number of forces. And of course, they have to be based somewhere, so military bases as well. In the case of Syria, ISIS is also there, also target, also the pretext for the U.S. military bombing of Syria that began in 2014. But in Syria, it seems as if ISIS is just to be managed, more or less. It's not a priority to defeat and degrade or degrade and defeat ISIS. In the case of Iraq, when ISIS seized Mosul, the United States was in a state of alarm or panic, it seemed to me. But is the United States really intent on, quote, defeating ISIS in Iraq? Is that why it's there? Or is there some other reason that the U.S. military is there and the contingent of troops just grows and grows?
Maybe they are. It doesn't really matter whether the current phase of the destruction of Iraq is Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Saddam Hussein or whatever the excuse is given at that particular moment. Defeating ISIS will not by itself stabilize Iraq. And the way that defeating ISIS is being planned, it's planned in a way that will only replace ISIS by other sectarian militias. We all remember how the U.S. made it seem as if killing al-Zarqawi or defeating al-Qaeda in Iraq was the ultimate goal. And al-Zarqawi was killed, and Osama bin Laden himself was killed. And al-Qaeda in Iraq was weakened. But now no one is talking about that anymore because we moved to the next phase, which is the ISIS crisis. So there will always be some manufactured reason to justify the U.S. military intervention in Iraq. There are at least a few dozen reasons that were given by the last four administrations to justify U.S. military interventions in Iraq. And whether ISIS existed or not, I assure you that there will be another excuse given. So it's not really about finding reasons to be there. It's about finding reasons not to be there. And that is the way to look at the situation in Iraq. The policy has to be switched to a policy that would plan our relationship with Iraq around us not interfering. And if we really wanted to do that, there are many other ways to ensure that Iraq is set on the path of stability, reconstruction, and healing and reconciliation. And these things definitely do not include U.S. troops. U.S. troops have been bombing the country and on the ground in the country for the last couple of decades. Obviously, Iraq is not moving in the right direction. So the U.S. military intervention was never a part of the solution. It has always been a part of the problem. And finding more reasons to justify it is easy. So what we need is a shift of policy. A shift of policy to say, enough is enough. Our role in Iraq has to be shifted from us interfering in the country to stopping the U.S. military, economic, and political intervention. And that will change the policy. And that will help us and will help Iraqis shift the situation inside Iraq to start the process of healing.
That's the voice of Ra'ed Gerard, an Iraqi-American journalist and government relations manager at the American Friends Service Committee. We're talking about the fact that President Obama has decided to send more U.S. troops to Iraq, 600 more. Ra'ed, you had mentioned that the U.S. has been at war in Iraq for a long time. There was the 1991 war, the George H.W. Bush 1 war. Many nations participated. It had UN authorization. It was a massive bombing campaign against all of Iraq in order on the pretext of evicting Iraq from Kuwait. Then there were economic sanctions on Iraq by the Clinton administration starting in December 1998 after the U.S. Senate passed a bill saying that regime change rather than weapons containment was the main policy. The U.S. began bombing Iraq and they bombed it every day. I went to Iraq in August, September 2002, just about 9 months before the 2003 invasion. And I went to Basra and Mosul and all around the country. And I was traveling with Ramsey Clark and others. And we were going to wherever the U.S. had bombed the day or night before to sort of see why was the bombing taking place, to talk to the people who were the victims of the bombing. And one of the things that I noticed, because I had been to Iraq during the 90s, we were bringing medicine to Iraq in defiance of U.S. economic sanctions, was by August, September 2002, there was, for the first time, the pharmacies actually had medicine in them, and they had had no medicine in the 1990s. It looked like the sanctions were starting to fray, but now the U.S. began the daily bombing. And I asked some Iraqis what they thought of it, and they just looked at me perplexed, and they said, why are you, meaning America, why are you doing this to us? Why? I mean, from an Iraqi perspective, I mean, from anybody's perspective, but certainly from an Iraqi perspective, I mean, there must be like astonishment and sort of confusion, unless there's some political narrative that explains what's happened.
There is confusion because there is no unified narrative in Iraq anymore. Iraq as it exists now is not a unified country. It has been broken into three or four or five different states within the borders of what historically was referred to as Iraq. And this destruction of the state happened very systematically under the U.S. intervention. So there is no one prevailing narrative about the U.S. war since 1991. But I would say the majority of Iraqis view the U.S. role as negative. I don't think Iraqis, regardless of their ethnic or political or sectarian background at this stage, would think of the U.S. role in Iraq as a positive one. The Obama administration, with their confused policies, really lost everyone. They lost the pro-war factions in Iraq because he wasn't pro-war enough. They lost the anti-war factions and anti-intervention groups in Iraq as well because he continued the intervention. So I don't think there are many big fans of the Obama administration or the United States as a country anymore. There is definitely a feeling that the U.S. played a role in destroying Iraq, and there are many voices demanding that the U.S. stop the intervention and start thinking about how to compensate Iraqis. And that is something that I have mentioned on your show a couple of times before. Iraqis, unlike Americans, are very familiar with systems of compensation. And this is one of the biggest ironies. And Iraq has been involved in a very comprehensive system of compensation because of the Iraqi illegal and immoral invasion and occupation of Kuwait. So the United Nations Compensation Committee, UNCC, was established to oversee this compensation that Iraq is paying to Kuwait. And many Iraqis wonder how come they are not being compensated by the same mechanism for the destruction that happened in their country after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 1991, the war that started in 1991. So the mechanism is out there, and I encourage all of your audiences to check it out, the United Nations Compensation Committee. They have been taking money from Iraq since 1991 and paying it to Kuwait. And many people think that this might be a good system for making the U.S. compensate Iraq for all of the death and destruction that was caused by the U.S. intervention.
That's Raed Gerard, Iraqi American journalist. Raed, I mean, that is like really an important point, and I think our audience should know about it and think about it, and we should do more about it, because the compensation program that was created by the United Nations following Saddam Hussein's ordered invasion of Kuwait in early August 1990. You're saying, does it continue? Because part of the compensation is not only to the Kuwaiti government and the Kuwaiti royal family, money that came from Iraq and from its oil profits and from the oil for food program. It also went to American corporations that were doing business in Kuwait. I mean, Iraqis who were suffering and who were losing 8,000 people per month, according to the UN, to economic sanctions, 5,000 of them babies and children, and most of the rest their grandparents, the more vulnerable elements in society, they were taking money from Iraq's depleted resources and giving it to the Kuwaiti government and to American corporations. And the UN and the U.S., they demanded it.
And do you remember what former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, said about that. She said, when they asked her, she said it was worth it to kill all of these babies. It was worth it to kill all of these babies for whatever U.S. policy existed. Yeah, I mean, the compensation system is still exists until today, and Iraq is still paying 5% of its income because the U.N. still, you know, running that program. So, and I really think it's a really interesting issue to discuss. I know we don't have time today because I have to hop off the interview in a minute, but maybe we can dedicate a longer conversation about this. I can give you and your audiences a little bit more context to how the compensation was estimated, how it's being paid legally and economically, and the implications of it. It's a really interesting topic to take on.
Yeah, we do have just 2 minutes left. I want to ask you real quickly, Rudd, and I know you are running as well. A CNN article profiled earlier in this week a woman named Wahida Mohammed from a village south of Mosul. She's been fighting ISIS along with others in the sectarian militia that you talked about. She said, I fought them, I beheaded them, I cooked their heads, I burned their bodies. I mean, it's an important thing because you on this show and elsewhere have been talking about that. It's not just ISIS that's carrying out these kind of atrocities, which is the atrocities we hear about, but it really is all of these sectarian militias. And it's not condemned by CNN. It's just sort of a curiosity.
Celebrated.
Yeah. Well, in the last minute, talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. My take on the situation in Iraq is that we don't have one bad guy called ISIS, and we're trying to get rid of them by collaborating with good allies. The situation is we have brutal sectarian militias committing war crimes and beheadings and rape on all sides, whether they were Shiites or Kurdish or Sunni or Christian or Yazidis. And the U.S. is supporting some of these brutal sectarian militias against others. So there are really no good militias and bad militias in Iraq. There are the ones who we support and the ones who we don't.
Yeah. All right. We're out of time. We've been joined by Rudd Jarar, an Iraqi-American journalist, a government relations manager at the American Friends Service Committee. We've been talking about President Obama's decision in the last months of his administration to send more, not fewer, troops to Iraq. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The resistance to the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline continues at Standing Rock as the government intensifies its repression. 21 people were arrested this Wednesday during a peaceful protest, but activists are showing no signs of going anywhere despite the brutal tactics from military-style law enforcement. We are joined by Dennis Banks. He was born on Leech Lake Indian Reservation in Minnesota. He co-founded the American Indian Movement in 1968 and has led or organized many struggles for the rights of Native America, from 1972 Trail of Broken Treaties to the 71-day occupation of Wounded Knee. He is also the 2016 vice presidential candidate of the Peace and Freedom Party in California and is also on the ballot in many other states. Welcome, Dennis Banks.
Yes, good to be on your show here.
Great. Thank you so much for joining. It's a great honor. Let's start with the latest news out of Standing Rock, where protests have been raging against the Dakota Access Pipeline. You were there. You were at Standing Rock. Is the repression intensifying? What are the images we're seeing of militarized police arresting people, brutalizing people?
It is intensifying, Brian. On one hand, we have the big camp at Standing Rock, which is, I would say it would be the political part of the camp, and dealing with the issues of court issues, the legalities of scraping and digging up bones and stuff like that. Those are the ones that where the big encampment is at. There is a smaller part of the camp. It's an offshoot of the camp, which is they're taking a much harder stand with those people that are digging and scraping and constructing the pipeline itself. There's about 100, maybe 100, maybe, I don't know the strength of them, but I've visited their camp many times and, you know, listened to their their strategy, and I told them we're going to tweak it a little bit, and you know, and always sort of recognize what the major stand is about, and you know, hang close to those goals. But we see the state of North Dakota. They are now beefing up their side with the national. They nationalized the National Guard, so they're there, which was allowing them to use in many ways military equipment to support protect, as they say, the efforts of the pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. This part, I think that is really questionable, and I think that's going to have to be resolved in the court. But I think the state of North Dakota believe that they have the ultimate authority in that area, and they're going to ignore the court, the warning of the court. But that's where we're at right now. There.
Okay, so let's help the audience understand. The Standing Rock Sioux tribe has sued the federal government, saying that the Native American tribe was not properly consulted over the project to construct a 1,160-mile crude oil pipeline that extends over four states. It's really about whose land it is. And the lawsuit says that the government didn't consult. Are they legally required to consult with the original owners of this land, with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe?
They are absolutely required to get to be in consultation with the tribe, but not just consultation. They have to meet the guidelines. They have to meet if the tribe, of course, doesn't want it, then that's the position that the tribe has to be, their position has to be honored. And if they feel, I'm talking in broad terms here, if any tribe feels that there's sacred sites, if there's burial sites, then they will move to protect those sites. And that's in our legal field, that's what we're fighting there. And then there's also the Environmental Protection Act, which we have the gray wolf is there, the sturgeon is in that area, the black-footed ferret. These are areas which the Environmental Protection Agency, it's they're the ones that are saying that they're endangered in that area. So, but the Corps and the Dakota Access Pipeline, they're ignoring those guidelines of the whole area.
Right. So the U.S. government has treaty obligations with the original inhabitants in the area, the Sioux tribe. The project developer, Dakota Access, a subsidiary of Energy Transfer Crude Oil, says the pipeline would help the United States become less dependent on importing energy from unstable regions of the world, meaning presumably the Middle East. But that's really not true because, of course, the United States has a glut in oil. Oil prices are at an all-time low, you know, measured by 2016 currencies. It's really about profits. It's really about the profits of this Energy Transfer crude oil company versus the rights of indigenous peoples who have lived there for thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of years. And it seems to me that this is perhaps more than any other struggle for indigenous populations, a crystallizing moment where people are coming together from not just North Dakota, not just the Dakotas, but all over the world. They're coming to Standing Rock. They've been coming. And the government is coming in on the side of the corporations. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've always held that, there's two treaties involved, 1851 and 1868 treaty. Those, both of them, if you read them, put them all down on paper and look at it, we have the ultimate authority on there. And I believe that the government, you know, in supporting, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline is really, and I think they're on the wrong side of history on this one. And as long as they support the efforts of Dakota Access, then there's nothing that we can do except to say, look, you cannot cross this line. We're going to be here to defend it. We don't want you crossing it. And that's the way it's going to stand out. And no matter how, what kind of permits that the Dakota Access Pipeline manufacturer or the Corps of Engineers, they're wrong in the beginning. And they'll be wrong in the end, you know. I'm kind of shocked that the Obama administration has kind of looked the other way on this one. But I can understand, you know, when government is being run by corporations. Corporations will always win in their eyes. They're winning, but in our historical stand, we're gonna win on this one. And we have, as you mentioned, we have worldwide support on this one. And I think that there's going to be a major change in November elections. It's going to be a big, major part of what's what in America in terms of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation. And a lot of people, many corporations, over 300 flags that are from different nations, they are in support of Standing Rock. Never before in the history of I've seen, I'm 80 years old, I've not seen this kind of solid support coming for one little issue of, well, in terms, it's a big issue, but Standing Rock is a small little tribe, but here we have worldwide support, and I'm very proud to be part of that support and taking on the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yeah, you never know when things are going to jump off. I mean, a single spark sets a prairie fire, as the old expression goes. Rosa Parks was down in Montgomery, Alabama, when she started the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. Nobody would have expected that the mass civil rights movement would come from a place like Montgomery, where the oppression was so great, a small place. But sometimes things just happen like that. I mean, there have been thousands of activists, Indian, Native, Indigenous activists, who have come together at Standing Rock. I mean, the government is throwing a lot of repression at them. Dogs are biting people. They're busting people. They're breaking up prayer sessions. But do you think it's going to stiffen the resistance? I mean, trying to give our audience a sense of the mood there, because you were there.
Because, well, the one thing, when at Wounded Knee, we were up against the law, and when you're at that point, then things could escalate very quickly. And this, what happened on Wounded Knee, we were up against the wall. We were having a meeting, and all of a sudden we heard gunshots going on site. And the security came running in and said, they're shooting at us. The feds are shooting at us. What should we do? What should we do? And in the meeting, everybody turned around and they said, fire back. Fire back.
Okay, I want to help the audience understand this exactly, Dennis Banks, because we're talking about the 71-day standoff. I remember it vividly. I was in New York City at the time, but there were a lot of activities all around the world, all around the country, including in New York City, to show solidarity with the action that you took. That was an armed standoff. I mean, there was gunfire between indigenous people, activists at Wounded Knee. Of course, Wounded Knee was the site of the great massacre by the U.S. cavalry and the FBI and the U.S. Government forces. But what you're telling us is that military sort of standoff, that shootout that happened at Wounded Knee, that was provoked because the U.S. government started shooting, and then the people said, guess what? We're going to stand up. We're going to defend ourselves. We're going to shoot back. That's what happened.
That's right. That's right. But right now, we're at the same political level in terms of taking that stand. We're gonna continue to use the courts. Every angle, every piece of evidence, the Environmental Protection Agency. We're gonna draft help from every source of people and nations that can help us and get it. Before the United Nations, it's already. Dave Archambault, our great chairman out there, has already went before the UN committee on indigenous rights. And this is getting worldwide attention through the United Nations and through the, these people are just coming over there. We can't stop this. We can't stop the pour of really love, support, and people bringing in truckloads of logs to make sure that we have firewood throughout the winter and warm clothing. We're getting support from companies that make big blankets, comforters, and so I don't want to give out any information on who they are. Otherwise, the feds might go to lean on them again as they did before.
But what you're saying is that the people are trying to keep this and have been keeping this protest peaceful. the government has employed, and the company cooperating with the company has employed, a lot of violence to repress peaceful protesters. But you have public opinion on your side, and that's growing. And that's the thing. That's the thing that could actually make the decisive, important impact. You had the Keystone Pipeline. That looked like it was a sure thing 8 years ago, but masses of people engaged in peaceful civil disobedience, mass protest. And finally, the Obama administration, in spite of its initial inclination to support the pipeline, sort of withdrew. In other words, victory, you can conceive of a victory at Standing Rock through these kind of methods.
Yes, I believe we can. I believe, you know, as we did in 73, that if we give out enough information about what's happening there, then the people will continue to pour in their support. So that's what we're hoping for, and that's what the ceremonies are doing, you know, for us. We have ceremonies every day, you know, big encampment there. There's no weapons allowed, and you know, it will escalate beyond any kind of hope. Only if the U.S. government or even the state government unleashes, you know, military power against us, then I think that things will worsen, but the pride will be on our side.
Right. We're talking to Dennis Banks about the struggle at Standing Rock. Dennis Banks was a founder in 1968 of the American Indian Movement. You had in the United States the Black Panther Party representing the struggle for black liberation, the Young Lords Party representing the struggle of Puerto Rican people in the United States and on the island fighting for liberation. And we had the American Indian Movement that Dennis Banks was one of the leaders of. It made a profound impact on public opinion in the United States. And right now that movement is surging again around Standing Rock, where Dennis Banks has been. Dennis, let me ask you, we have about 2.5 minutes to go here. North Dakota's Governor Jack Dalrymple has declared a state of emergency. Dalrymple is also an advisor to Donald Trump's campaign. Talk about his policies and the effect they've had on Standing Rock. I mean, these are where the oil tycoons are wined and dined, and they wine and dine elected officials, and where the governor serves as an advisor, not only to the Trump campaign, but to the corporate entities. Talk about that.
Well, we know that the Trump campaign is totally against any kind of Indian support. And it is hostile towards Indian people, mainly because when the United States Supreme Court held that we had a right to build casinos and engage in casino games, of course, issued many, many statements throughout in the early parts of when we were building campaigns, you know, that what do Indians know about gaming? What do they know about gambling? You know, they're straight from the teepee. And try to say where they're straight from the cave. And he was using remarks like that. So I don't see any help coming from a political person like that. It's going to be dangerous. It's going to be dangerous the way how he spells out things. And we've watched what he's been saying about other minority people. And so from the beginning, when Trump casinos started go head on against Indian casinos. Indian casinos won. You know, we went from a $15 billion now to a $35 billion operation just in casinos alone. And Trump has been hurting ever since. So that's only the face of it. That's one point of why he's against Native peoples.
That's so interesting. Donald Trump, the so-called billionaire who hates the struggle, your struggle, the struggle of indigenous people, because he's a competitor. He's a casino competitor.
Right, absolutely.
And also, of course, he is a racist. So that's a toxic combination. Dennis Banks, we're completely out of time. I want to thank you so much. It's a great honor that you were able to join our show, Loud and Clear. We'll be back Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.